Hello, Tess. Take us back to the PNG elections, if you please.
Good evening, Philip. Yes, well, it's been a bit of a long-running saga, but it is now coming to a close, the elections in PNG. Parliament has set and James Marape has been returned as Prime Minister. He was unanimously voted in, 97-0, by the MPs that were in the chamber.
No, he has been sworn in, I understand it, but not for lots of portfolios like our ex-Prime Minister.
Not at this stage. He's appointed an interim cabinet of five, and we're expecting him to make some more announcements about ministerial allocations in the next little while.
So this is the 11th Parliament.
It is, that's right. So they have elections every 5 years, and as you say, this is the 11th Parliament. There will be a change in the lineup. A few of the old faces have gone, and significantly and pleasingly, there will be two women in the lineup. So there were no women in the previous Parliament, but there will be two women in this Parliament.
Now, I understand we're looking at least seven parties in the coalition.
Yes, I mean, that's not unusual for Papua New Guinea that government coalitions do comprise large numbers of parties. Some of those parties may only have one or two members, but it does mean in terms of going forward, it means that it's a constant kind of juggling act for Marape to make sure that he can keep everybody in the mix. He has an 18-month grace period, and so for the first 18 months of the Parliament, it's not possible for him to be put to the test by virtue of a motion of no confidence.
Tess, I understand there's still a few challenges to the votes going on.
Well, so there's still a few votes to be finalised. I think we will be expecting to hear that there will be a number of challenges to results as the results get formalised. So there will be a process by which people can put forward a challenge, and those challenges will be heard in the courts.
Now, the last time we spoke, you were telling us there's 140 women who stood in the recent election, and the outcome is two have been elected.
That's right. So it's still two of that cohort that stood, and there's 118 seats in the Parliament. So it's still a very small proportion. But obviously, having gone from a position where there were none to have two is a significant achievement. And I think it's something that generally people are feeling very positive about. The two women are, they'd both stood in the 2017 elections. So they're quite seasoned campaigners. One of them, Kessie Sawang, has an awful lot of experience as an economist, so hopefully she'll be able to put those skills to good use in the Parliament.
And Rufina Peter?
Rufina Peter has a governor's seat, one of the provincial governor's seats. At the moment, we're not quite sure how the opposition is going to look, but she was she stood as part of Peter O'Neill's PNC party. So we expect that will be, they will form part of the opposition bloc, and assuming that she, you know, remains loyal to that party, she will sit in opposition. It may not be a very big opposition, so she may actually get a bit more airtime than she would do otherwise.
Words of wisdom from Tess Newton-Cain, project leader at the Pacific Hub at Griffith University in Queensland. Now, Tess, we flirted earlier in the month with Natel Whiting and Maho Lavelle about the problems with the election process. Will there be any reflection on how to better manage the election process?
Well, I think we can expect from the observer missions, whether it's the Commonwealth or the Melanesian Spearhead Group or whatever, they will each make a report. And I think we can expect there to be some quite significant criticisms, and they will be putting forward recommendations for reform. Unfortunately, that there's a bit of a pattern there. We've seen that happen before. It really comes down to political will on the part of the new government to get some really structural things addressed and fixed. And it also means that, you know, they obviously need to allocate some resources to that. But it's really, you know, it's a five-year job. So in order for there to be any hope that things will be better for the elections in 2027, the work on getting those things right really needs to start now.
I guess the new Prime Minister's already had a cheery phone call from Albanese, but aren't they expected to meet sometime in the not too distant?
Yeah, so Prime Minister Albanese actually addressed this at a press conference in Brisbane today. So he is expecting to meet with Mr. Marape at the PNG Australia ministerial meeting. The dates for that haven't been set, but Mr. Albanese also advised, and I know you'll be thrilled about this, Philip, also advised that he's invited Mr. Marape to come to Brisbane for the Prime Minister's 13 rugby league match that will be held in September. So we can look forward to that with bated breath.
I don't approve of sport, but moving on, the US Deputy Secretary of State, that I think Wendy Sherman, of course, has been gallivanting around the Pacific as a part of the of Biden's re-engagement. And she was in the Solomons to celebrate the 80th anniversary of the Battle of Guadalcanal.
She was. She was accompanied by Ambassador Kennedy, who obviously, and both of them told very personal stories. Obviously, the story of John F. Kennedy being rescued by Solomon Islanders during the war is quite a famous one. But Deputy Secretary Sherman also spoke of the fact that her father had served in Solomon Islands and I think had been injured there. So they, you know, it was quite a personal event for both of those women. They spent 2 or 3 days in Honiara, which was, you know, meant that they got to meet with a range of people. They met with media people and they met with, I think they met with some opposition people.
I remember standing on a mountaintop in Solomon Islands, gazing down at this, what is beneath the surface, a huge graveyard of ships.
An iron bottom sound. Yeah, just a huge amount of just like the amount of materiel that was, you know, just left behind.
Does the celebration of World War II battles mean anything to Solomon Islanders these days?
Well, I think that's a really important question, because it is something that the administration and American interlocutors make a big deal of, is that that is the hook that they build this on. Where the impacts of World War II really hit home for Solomon Islanders, or one of the areas which was raised with Sherman when she was in the country, is that every day Solomon Islanders are dealing with the ongoing impacts of huge amounts of unexploded ordnance all throughout the country. So there were 13 bombs discovered on an island, one of the outlying islands, just last week. So this is a huge impost on Solomon Islands. They're basically carrying that impact for a war that they had no interest in. It wasn't their war. And it's having some really important impacts on the development of the country.
I understand that both the US and Australia are tossing a few dollars in that direction.
Yeah, so the Americans pledged a further $1 million towards clearing of the ordnance. The Australians have had a small but ongoing program working with the Solomon Islands police to, you know, locate these bombs, move them to a safe point and detonate them safely. But it's just such a huge issue. It's affecting, you know, whether people can build a house or extend a garden, or never mind more sort of big public infrastructure projects. So I think it's something that the Americans in particular really have to come to grips with. It's been made clear to them that that's what's expected and that's what's wanted. So they need to have an answer to that, I think.
Meanwhile, what's going on in Vanuatu?
Well, in Vanuatu, not to be left out, so the opposition has lodged a motion of no confidence, which was due to be heard on Tuesday in Parliament. That didn't happen because there was no quorum. So the next opportunity for that motion to be heard will be on Friday, where there isn't the need to have 2/3 of the MPs in the House for the House to sit. Now, motions of no confidence are not particularly uncommon in Vanuatu. What's making this situation different is that the government, the Loughman government, responded to that by going to the president and seeking a dissolution of parliament, which would put the country into facing snap elections. We've yet to hear from the president's office what his decision is on that.
Something else in the neighbourhood, the vicissitudes of High Court Judge David Lambourne.
Yeah, so this is in Kiribati, quite a worrying situation. I was in fairly regular contact with David during last week. He's been subject to a number of machinations on the part of the government to try and get him removed from his position as a High Court judge. He was essentially kept out of the country for 2.5 years by virtue of COVID, plus the government refusing to issue a visa. He got back home, because Kiribati is his home. He got back home on the 1st of August, but then there was a further attempt to deport him last week. That was avoided by virtue of combinations of legal activity and the steadfastness of Fiji Airways' pilot. So the Court of Appeal will hear a substantive matter on Friday relating to this. And I think what's interesting there is that because of Lambourne being suspended and then the Chief Justice also being suspended when he sought to intervene in the Lambourne issue, there is actually no effective High Court in Kiribati at the moment. So it's pretty parlous, I think, in terms of the rule of law.
Good on you, Tess. The voice of Dr. Tess Newton-Cain, project leader at the Pacific Hub at Griffith University in Queensland and a regular on the Little Wireless program.
Think bigger about the world we live in. Ask your smart speaker to play ABC RN.